Hello, this is Wendy Bauer reading to you today, December 4th, 2017, from the Decatur Herald and Review, and we'll begin on the front page with an article written by Donette Beckett as part of the Together Decatur series, Success in Trial by Error. Decatur music teacher Richard Kubo notes a different approach from Decatur. Richard Kubo has a different approach to teaching music, reading notes, as well as listening by ear. Although I had all these years of lessons, I taught myself how to play by ear, said Kubo, namesake of Richard's Music School. As a child, Kubo practiced classical piano, such as Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. As a teenager, he longed to play the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and Doors. Most of the rock musicians in the 60s never had a music lesson in their life, he said. He learned how they did it. Kubo compares the process of learning to play by ear as that of a child learning to speak. During the first 5 years of life, a child learns to talk without the aid of books or reading. Playing by ear is the same thing, he said. Students learn by trial and error when practicing a simple song such as Mary Had a Little Lamb. Children learn to correct their speech by listening to their parents. At age 3, they may say me instead of I, Kubo said as an example. The child that used to mix up sentences doesn't anymore. Kubo, 65, adds chords, then a melody. He estimated the processes of being able to play in a musical setting, such as a church, takes about 2.5 years. Rajad Singh's son and daughter take lessons from Kubo, as does Singh. He recommends it, his taking lessons, so the kids can see what they are doing wrong when they are at home, Singh said. His daughter, Gurleen Kaur, has been learning piano. His son, Tegber, has been taking guitar lessons. Their mother began taking guitar lessons 5 months ago. Singh is learning the guitar, piano, and drums. He takes his time and goes down to the basics, Singh said. If something doesn't work, he tries a different way. Kubo said his teaching techniques took years for him to learn as well. He began his music school shortly after he came back to Decatur 11 years ago from Jackson, Mississippi, where he had lived since 1978. He returned to care for his ailing parents and decided to stay in Decatur after they passed away. The children are taught to read notes and then they learn to play by ear. Kubo usually teaches the adults by ear. Jackie Getter, 67, decided to take lessons after her musically inclined sons had grown. They have moved away, but the piano is still there, she said. Getter said Kubo is very supportive of all his students, particularly patient with the children. You have to have personality traits that help others learn, she said. Although he had a degree in business, he opened his music store and the Decatur School because he loves music. He doesn't make much money, he said, but he doesn't regret his career. His goal is to help others find their dream, he said. He may know how to read music, but he enjoys learning a new song by ear as well, something he is happy to show his students. I had to teach the kids the same way I learned, by trial and error, he said. And the article is accompanied by a picture of Richard Kubo working with 8-year-old Tegber Singh during his guitar music class at the Business Center of Decatur. And the article notes that to schedule music lessons at Richard's Music School, visit richardsmusicschool.com or call 217-853-2807. This was from the Together Decatur series, and the article says, do you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. Or dbeckett@herald-review.com. And next on the front page, highway setbacks looming. July budget agreement takes back $300 million, puts Illinois roads in crisis. Tom Lisi from the Herald and Review writes from Decatur, 6 months after lawmakers hastily passed their first state budget in 2 years, transportation advocates are sounding the alarm on a little-noticed item that will take $300 million from road repairs to pay other expenses each year. Many lawmakers have only recently been briefed on the measure, which escaped much notice at the time. It stems from limited funding and other legislative priorities, with lawmakers acting under intense pressure after 2 years without a budget and the state's backlog of unpaid bills topping $14 billion. This move was a total surprise, said Macon County engineer Bruce Bird. You know, county engineers were told by the folks at the Illinois Department of Transportation when they had discussions with legislators, it was, "We did what?" So I'm guessing it's a surprise to just about everybody. The result, transportation advocates say, is a fatal blow to the Illinois Department of Transportation's construction schedule that was already struggling to keep up with deteriorating roads and bridges. After the budget passed, IDOT's planned highway improvements went from 400 miles of work to 189, a fraction of the more than 3,500 miles of state roads currently in need of reconstruction across Illinois. An IDOT spokeswoman said the department remains committed to creating and maintaining a world-class system of infrastructure. The department will continue to work with all stakeholders on this mission and to strengthen the state's status as the transportation hub of North America, said spokeswoman Kelsey Gursky. Most of the diverted money is paying for bonds that were used to make already completed improvements to the Regional Transportation Authority, which serves public transit in the Chicago area. Before the budget agreement, IDOT's capital plan said 40% of all state roads would be in need of repair by 2023. Now, the road fund, which is the primary bank account for Illinois' transportation spending, will be depleted well before that. "We had a tourniquet on that was starting to fall off," said John Lauder, a lobbyist whose clients include the Transportation for Illinois Coalition. "Now we're opening up arteries and we're bleeding out." When asked about the road fund diversion, the governor's office and state Senate leaders each blamed their political enemies. "The idea for this came from the Senate Republicans on behalf of the Rauner administration," said John Patterson, spokesman for Senate President John Cullerton, Democrat from Chicago. Senate Minority Leader Bill Brady's office responded in an email. "This was a proposal that Democrats adopted, put in their budget, and passed mostly with Democrat votes in the Illinois Senate." A spokeswoman for Rauner said Brady's proposal as the lead Republican budget negotiator included $180 million from the road fund to pay for RTA bond payments. The Democrats enacted fiscal year 18 budget, which Governor Rauner vetoed, increased this cost shift to approximately $300 million, spokeswoman Elizabeth Tomev said. This all comes despite the fact that transportation advocates enjoy a strong bipartisan cadre of supporters, trades, unions, whose members carry out the work for capital projects, and business leaders whose companies rely on a strong transportation network to keep up the flow of commerce. "I have trucks going all over the place, and I can tell there are a lot of roads where you can't avoid the issues," said John Skeffington, president of Decatur-based Skeff Distributing, a major beer distributor in central Illinois. "You can really tell as you drive west when you get back into Illinois. It's a mess." Every $1 million in road project spending equates to about 15 full-time construction jobs, said David Tyrolt, president of Dunn Company in Decatur. So that loss of $300 million represents 4,500 jobs across the state that are going to be lost. Our employees, they'll suffer some of that loss themselves. IDOT's highway improvement plan for the current fiscal year had to eliminate more than 200 miles of construction work. Before the July budget agreement, the agency had planned to repeat its average workload, about 400 miles a year. Kevin Burke, vice president of the Illinois Asphalt Pavement Association, says IDOT would need to complete work on 800 miles of state road every year in order to keep its current conditions, which are already noticeably bad. "We were bleeding at 400 miles of roads a year before the budget deal," he said. "Now we're bleeding at 600 miles a year." For businesses like SCEF in Decatur, the silver lining would be that IDOT officials would likely prioritize main thoroughfares like the interstate system and national highways like Interstates 55 and 72 and US 51. But Illinois 121, some of the lesser routes are going to be the ones that start to deteriorate, Lauder said. The stakes are that much higher for road funding considering the unique relationship between state and federal funding. Traditionally, the U.S. Department of Transportation has paid for close to 80% of states' highway projects, but only after the work has been completed. Put another way, in order for Illinois to receive the maximum amount of federal highway dollars, it has to have enough available cash. IDOT needs to be able to fund projects that are a lot larger than the actual cost, so they have to have cash flow to then get reimbursed, Burke said. While 26 states have raised their motor fuel tax since 2013, Illinois has stayed at 19 cents a gallon since 1990. "A lot of states have been stepping up to the plate the last few years," said Brian Termail, Director of Public Affairs at Associated General Contractors of America. "I think Illinois is in the most dire situation." The specter of another tax increase in Illinois is daunting, both for elected officials and residents, such as Gene Hansen in Decatur. "They'll raise the taxes to cover that, and then they'll borrow the money to pay for something else," she said. "I don't trust Illinois government." Still, Termail said, taxes collected and used for a specific purpose, like motor fuel taxes, tend to be more popular with voters. Focus groups show that people prefer knowing they will pay for a specific purpose, with a result that they can see and that will provide a direct benefit to them. Transportation advocates say a major lift will have to take place just to prevent a slide of road conditions today, with more revenue and bond sales together. "We're not even talking about money that we need for new roads, congestion relief, or airports. This is the most important," Lauder said. "This has got to be reversed." There's a note to this article about this story. This is the second part of a two-story series about road problems in the region. The first part was in yesterday, Sunday's Herald and Review. The complete series with photos and maps is available at herald-review.com. And next, history goes beyond two centuries. Before becoming a state, Illinois had its own Liberty Bell. This is by Travis Lott. "No exploration of the 200 years of Illinois history would be complete without a look at what preceded those two centuries. While Illinois became a state in 1818, its story began nearly 150 years before that, in 1673, when Louis Joliet and Jacques Marquette explored the Mississippi River in search of a route to the Pacific Ocean. When the two explorers' travels led them near hostile Spanish territories, they turned back and traveled along the Illinois River, finding safety among the Kaskaskia Indian tribe. Marquette founded the Mission of the Immaculate Conception, but left the mission in the hands of Father Pierre Gabriel Marest due to Marquette's poor health. The mission had to be moved several times due to conflicts between the Kaskaskia, Illini Confederation, and the Iroquois. Eventually, the mission planted roots at the confluence of the Mississippi River and the Mishagami River, which is now known as the Kaskaskia River. The village of Kaskaskia was established in 1703 and was mainly inhabited by French traders and their wives. The village's fertile ground in the American Bottoms, along with its positioning at the confluence of two rivers, led it to be a hub of agriculture and trading. It also became a focal point for warring British and French during the French and Indian War. In 1756, fearing attack, the townspeople built Fort Kaskaskia on a hill overlooking the town. The fort was then destroyed by the townspeople, who feared it would fall into British control after the French lost the war. Those who did not want to live under the impending British rule moved to St. Louis or St. Genevieve, Missouri. The town fell to the British and was kept under control of the Crown until July 4, 1778, when George Rogers Clark led an expedition of American troops into the village to liberate it. After a two-month journey over 1,000 miles, Clark and his 175 men arrived in Kaskaskia to take the area. Many of the British had been withdrawn from the area, and Clark captured the settlement without a shot being fired. With Clark in town, residents rang the Liberty Bell of the West, which got its name that day. The bell was originally given to the Catholic Church of the Illinois country by King Louis XV of France. The bell was cast in France in 1741, making it 11 years older than the Liberty Bell that sits in Philadelphia. An inscription on the side of the bell reads, "Pour l'Église des Illinois par les soins du roi d'Autre," which translates to "For the Church of the Illinois by gift of the King across the water." One side of the bell is ornamented with the royal lilies of France. The other side bears a cross and pedestal, with the top and arms of the cross terminating in grouped fleur-de-lis. Taking Kaskaskia was the first step in Clark's plan to capture the western headquarters of the British at Detroit. The bell is now a tourist attraction, much like the Immaculate Conception Church that sits next door. And a side note to this article, over next year, Illinois newspapers to commemorate Illinois' bicentennial. Illinois turns 200 on December 3rd, 2018, and over the course of the next year, the Herald and Review is helping to commemorate the event. The Herald and Review, and dozens of publications throughout Illinois, will print a weekly series of articles featuring key moments, figures, industries, and events that helped to make Illinois unique. Some of the first articles include the Underground Railroad, coal mining, the dueling Peoria Territory, and top Illinois athletes through the years. Other topics include Illinois' role in the Civil War, World War I, and World War II, transportation from the railroads to the interstates to aerospace, and the arts, including jazz and the blues. Newspapers contributing articles in this series include the Daily Herald of Arlington Heights, the Belleville News-Democrat, the Pantograph of Bloomington, the Southern Illinoisan of Carbondale, the News-Gazette of Champaign, the Chicago Defender, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Decatur Herald and Review, the paper from Dwight, the Galesburg Register-Mail, the Hancock Journal-Pilot, the Jacksonville Journal-Courier, the Lebanon Advertiser, the County Journal of Percy, the Journal Star of Peoria, the Dispatch Argus of Rock Island, the Rock River Times, the Rockford Register Star, and the State Journal Register of Springfield. The series will also be featured on the website 200illinois.com. And continuing on the front page, Decatur City Council to vote on $67.9 million budget. Ryan Voiles writes, 2 weeks after coming to terms with a budget proposal that could mean cuts to city services down the line, The Decatur City Council is set to vote on that budget during its meeting scheduled for tonight. The $67.9 million budget is accompanied by what is expected to be a relatively flat tax levy, similar to the current year's levy of $13.87 million. That property tax rate is equal to $1.65 per $100 of equalized assessed valuation. The budget isn't anything different than what we've talked about for the past several weeks, said Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus. The proposed budget runs a $3.2 million deficit, and city officials are hopeful that Illinois lawmakers would reverse recent cuts to local government funding in a new state budget agreement. If not, council members could spend next summer looking at possible cuts. Previous items brought before the council for reductions or elimination include $70,000 for the security and cleanup of the Decatur Celebration, $71,000 to the Senior Center, and $7,000 to the Sister City program. On top of a local decline in sales tax revenue and lagging economic activity, a July budget agreement between state lawmakers included pinching from long-relied-upon dollars for local governments. That means Decatur is set to lose $1.4 million compared with last year from a decrease in shares of both the sales tax and state income tax. The other deficit costs include $1.25 million in estimated back pay owed to Decatur police, who have worked without a union contract for more than a year. Overall receipts from local revenue, like the sales tax, cable tax, and the hotel tax, have declined, while the cost for the city's existing services have increased by 1.5%, city officials said. All that puts the city another $500,000 in the red. All this comes after it was announced Friday afternoon that Moody's Investor Services downgraded the city's credit rating from A1 to A2 with a negative outlook for improvement. And if you go, the Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. today in the Council Chambers, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. And moving to the local page, Tony Reed of the Herald and Review writes from Decatur, "New generation of love, dreaming of being home in the Millikan Mansion for Christmas." All visitors to the James Millikan Homestead want for Christmas is to never have to leave. Decked out Sunday afternoon for its annual Christmas open house tea, featuring refreshments, edible goodies, and live music, the 1875 Decatur Mansion built for banker and philanthropist James Millikan never looked better. Acres of sumptuously crafted woodwork made the perfect backdrop for festive garlands and decorations, while the dying rays of a December sun set a vast stained glass window afire in colored light. "Could I imagine life here? Yes, it's beautiful and I want to move in," said Shelley Barron, who lives in Decatur but was visiting the Italianate-style mansion for the first time. She arrived with a family group that included her 2-year-old great-niece, Layla Alexander, who had just discovered one of many glowing Christmas trees upstairs. "Pretty," she announced, before scampering off across hardwood floors that seemed to stretch into forever. Downstairs, it was much the same story, with first-time visiting couple Chelsea and Joseph Schmidt from Decatur stunned by what they found. "Could I live here? Sign me up," said Chelsea Schmidt. "What most appeals to me, it's the woodwork, the paneling and the woodwork. Homes nowadays are standardized, like the windows are a standard size, but everything here is custom-made." Joseph Schmidt could easily imagine he was home for the holidays and a whole lot longer. "I could do all year around here," he said with a smile. For those that have known and loved the grand old home for many years, everything was going according to their festive plan. Mary Lou Brown, a member of the James Millikan Homestead Board, which looks after the interior, said the Christmas event brings in new generations of people to fall in love with the home and want to see it preserved for all time. "I never get tired of the James Milliken homestead," said Brown. "I think it's just the beauty of it and the fact you don't just see craftsmanship like this anymore. It's awe-inspiring to me." Is there a ghost of Christmas past wandering around the Grand Mansion? Brown and current board president Terry Grant both said they've never seen one. "And I love being here by myself," said Grant. "This is a happy house." Next, prairie, not only thing preserved at Midewin. Preservationists are saving more than prairie at Midewin National Tall Grass Prairie. Even many of the ammunition bunkers left behind from the Joliet Army Ammunition Plant will be kept, as the U.S. Forest Service that oversees Midewin tells a story of the transition of the land through history. It's a story that includes the national prairie of prehistoric time, the Potawatomi people whose word Midewin provides the site its modern name, the farmers who came in the 19th century and drove hogs to market in Chicago along an old dirt road that remains, the Joliet Arsenal that was built to produce ammunition for World War II, the historic Route 66 highway that cuts through it, and the modern effort to restore 18,500 acres of prairie. It's a perfect circle of time, Midewin archaeologist Joe Wheeler said while surveying the foundations of an old farmstead that dates back to the Civil War era. Pointing to the dirt path that once was part of Blodgett Road, Wheeler told how Midewin visitors can walk over the same foundations as part of a hike that takes them past the old arsenal ammunition bunkers and to the bison that have been brought in to recreate an environment that existed hundreds of years ago. "Now, much of the past is left to the imagination. We always thought this was a trough," Wheeler said, of the stone outline of a former structure. "When we started doing some more research, this was a cooling tank for the dairy." The preservationists at Midewin don't plan to rebuild the farmsteads from the foundations that remain. However, the preservationists do plan to equip visitors with enough information by signboards, brochures, and mobile phone apps so people can take self-guided tours through the history that Midewin provides. Prairie supervisor Wade Spang pointed out that Midewin's Iron Bridge Trail crosses over Route 53, which is part of the historic Route 66. "We have Route 66 and this all in a 15 to 20 minute walk," Spang said. "When we get this all up and running, it's going to be pretty neat for people to come and walk around and learn about Midewin and the area and nature and all its grandeur." Some of the more recent history is being destroyed to make room for the deeper past. The Midewin National Tall Grass Prairie is one section of the old Joliet Arsenal that has been converted for new uses, including the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery and Center Point Intermodal Center at Elwood. About 300 old ammunition storage igloos still remain, even after 59 have been removed. The storage igloos commonly are called bunkers, but officially are called igloos by the U.S. Army. The area still has more than 50 other buildings, including old load and assembly plants. Although most of the igloos eventually will be removed, Midewin plans to keep a group of them near the Iron Bridge trailhead that will be part of the Circle of Time walk that goes through two farmstead ruins and the bison. "We're keeping them for the public to see what a bunker field looks like and what an igloo looks like," Spang said. "They'll be able to go in and enjoy and learn about that part of history here." And that concludes the first half of our reading today, December 4th, 2017, from the Decatur Herald and Review. We will take a short break now. Stay tuned, and we will return with our second half hour. Thank you.